Laura London, and this is the modern myth of speaking of young. Returning to us today for episode 141 is Professor Paul Bishop in Glasgow, Scotland. He studied at the University of Oxford's Magdalen College, where he was a doctoral candidate in the Faculty of Modern Languages and was awarded the prestigious Lady Julia Henry Fellowship to study abroad at Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts. He returned to Oxford and graduated with a PhD in German studies with a dissertation on C.G. Jung's reception of Friedrich Nietzsche, which was later published as the book The Dionysian Self. After serving for 12 years as professor of German at the University of Glasgow, he was named the William Jacks Chair in Modern Languages at the university's School of Modern Languages and Cultures, where he is currently an honorary professorial research fellow. Professor Bishop was the 2010 Zurich Lecturer at the International School of Analytical Psychology, known as ISAP, in Zurich, where he presented Reading Goethe at Midlife, Ancient Wisdom, German Classicism, and Jung. In 2022, he presented his essay, The Red Book and Other Searchers for the Soul, at the Aranos Conference, Jung's Red Book for Our Time, Searching for Soul in the 21st Century, later published as Volume 5 in the book series by Chiron Publications. His research is focused on the intellectual background of both psychoanalysis and Jungian psychology and its place in intellectual history. He has contributed chapters and essays to many books, including the Anthology of Contemporary Theoretical Classics and Analytical Psychology, The New Ancestors, as well as the recently published Where is Soul? Psychology in Modernity. He has edited several titles, including Jung in Contexts, The Persistence of Myth as Symbolic Form, and a companion to Goethe's Faust. He is also the author of over a dozen books, including Jung's Answer to Job, Nietzsche's The Antichrist, and Reading Plato Through Jung, which was the subject of our first interview, episode 131. His most recent book is the first of four planned volumes in his series, Jung and the Epic of Transformation, titled Wolfram von Eschenbach's Parzival and the Grail as Transformation, published last year by Chiron. And it was the subject of our second interview, episode 135. I've asked Professor Bishop to join me today to discuss a mutual interest of ours, the UFO phenomenon. We decided to tackle Jung's 1958 essay, Flying Saucers, A Modern Myth of Things Seen in the Skies, included in Volume 10 of his collected works, Civilization in Transition, and published as a book in many formats. Please consider helping Speaking of Jung stay on the air by contributing to our tip jar on Patreon for just $5 a month, and you will have access to all of my notes from the preparation I do for the featured episode of the month. Most of my notes don't make it into the recorded episode. Or by making a one-time or recurring donation through PayPal. Donors will receive my notes as well, and if you haven't received them, please send me an email. You can find the links in the description box below or by visiting the support page on our website, speakingofjung.com. You can also help our YouTube channel grow by clicking the thumbs up on this video. And if you haven't already, please subscribe to this channel. It's free and it helps us get more exposure. I am also here to remind you of the importance of recording your dreams. Temenos Dream is a revolutionary dream tracking app available for iOS and Android. Now you can record your dreams by speaking into your phone or typing them into the app. Search for myths, legends, and fairy tales related to the themes in your dreams. Use the new advanced AI interpretation with a focus on Jung's work, looking closely at symbols and associations to consider shadow, anima, animus, archetypes, and much more. You can help support Speaking of Jung simply by downloading the app and creating a free account. Unlimited use is available with a premium subscription. Click on the link in the description box below or on our website, speakingofjung.com, where you will find links to everything discussed in this episode in the show notes. This video interview is being recorded on Monday, April 14th, 2025, through the magic of StreamYard. It's great to see you again, Professor Bishop.
Well, it's great to see you, Laura. Thank you very much for your invitation, and thank you for all the work and preparation you do with your notes and getting all the details right, and even pronouncing Magdalen College the way they do in Oxford too.
Well, thank you for informing me of that. I struggle with a lot of pronunciations, and I want to get it right, so I had no idea. So I appreciate that.
Why should you?
Well, it's really great to see you again, as I said, and I really appreciate you joining me to cover this topic, which is so controversial. There are people on both sides. I don't think we're going to say what people expect us to say. I don't think people understand my point of view on this topic, and I have no idea what your point of view is. So I think it's brave of you to agree to talk about this with me.
Well, thank you for saying that. I mean, you're right in some ways that the entire topic of the UFO phenomenon is pretty much marginalized as far as academic study is concerned. But then there's so many things that are marginalized as far as academic study is concerned. And I think the essay that we're going to be looking at in particular detail is one that's been perhaps unjustly neglected in Jung's writings, but there it is in Collected Works Volume 10, and Volume 10 is very much, I think, the volume for our times, civilization in transition, and there's a lot of transition going on at the moment, as we all know. So if we can get folk looking at that volume and looking at this essay in particular, then I think it will be a job well done.
So as you mentioned, this essay of Jung's, which is very long, is included in his collected works here in Volume 10. This is the original hardcover edition you see on the screen, the original Bollingen series published by Princeton University Press. And I have here all of the book covers that I could find, because the essay, since it is so long, was published also as a book. And the first one I could find was this.
Great.
Then I found, which looks like a old hardcover edition. Then I found this. This is actually a small paperback, a Signet book, 75 cents.
Wow, that's good value.
I also found this, which looks like a hardcover edition. And if you search online for it, you'll find it available for hundreds of dollars. And when Princeton University Press came out with their updated version of Jung's collected works, I've never seen this in person. This is the Princeton paperback edition. So this was the hardcover edition. Here's the paperback edition of Jung's essay.
Interesting to see the different way that it's presented. The version which I've got here, holding up, is the one that was published by Routledge. That's the Routledge one. It's a rather lurid orange. Interestingly, very much like the orange in the Super Jung there, isn't it? That's a curious lap over there. And we've got this enormous eye looking upwards, referencing, I think, the correct title.
And I did see that, and I couldn't find a good photo of it. So I had no idea you had that version. The version I have is this. This is actually a scan of my book. I bought this hardcover edition, C.G. Jung, Flying Saucers, A Modern Myth of Things Seen in the Skies, so long ago that I remember bringing this to my analytic session with my analyst back when I was seeing her at her office on Chagrin Boulevard in Cleveland, Ohio. So it was prior to 1996. I think, because that's the year I left Cleveland. And I remember bringing this to her, and she said, "You read it and you tell me what it's about."
Right.
And I never did. I have struggled with this essay for years. I have asked people what they thought of it, who have read it. I have tried reading it with a friend and sharing notes and just gave up. Mm-hmm. I've heard people who aren't Jungians talk about it, and they completely, I think, miss the point. So let's just go over a couple more. This is the current Jung extract. They published a series of extracts from the collected works, and they have one on flying saucers, which includes the flying saucers essay in volume 10. And also there's that volume 18 of Jung's collected works, which is miscellaneous writings. So there are things from papers and articles from volume 18 in this as well. So you can just purchase this separately. All of these will be in the show notes. And then the most recent one I found, Professor Bishop, is this. This is new. This was actually from 2023.
Yeah, cool. That's very impactful, isn't it? Yeah.
So tell us, if you would, let me make sure I remove this correctly and add the Speaking of Jung banner back up. Okay. How did you first become interested, or why is that book in your collection?
That's a very good question. I think that fits into my own experience of coming across Jung as a thinker who was very much marginalized. And of course, having titles like this, like Flying Saucers, is not guaranteed to get you back into the mainstream in some ways. But I think if we look at this essay, to me it's testimony to Jung's almost uncanny knack of being able to synchronize what he's doing with the big issues and events of the day.
Okay.
In the post-war period. For various reasons, which we can consider as sociological, but also military, because, you know, getting aircraft that would perform extraordinary maneuvers was one of the big things that came out during the Cold War. UFOs were a kind of a big topic then, subject to films. There's the whole sci-fi angle. It's central to that epic series, The X-Files, of course, where this whole question of, you know, what's real, what isn't, stretches itself out. It becomes then an extraordinary kind of critique of the modern world and its obsession with security. Has an episode about a pandemic which strikes everybody low, which in retrospect looks quite prophetic, tempted to say. And of course, what the X-Files was doing was setting up that classic distinction between the Enlightenment, the critical thinker, the critical rationality, which was so wonderfully played by the role of Dana Scully, Gillian Anderson, as against the iconic remark, "I want to believe." And there's old Fox Mulder working away in his basement. And both of the characters have to change and modify their position. And I think Jung himself is part of this negotiation that's going on at the end of the 20th century, right into our own century, this negotiation that's taking place between the Enlightenment, rationality, a reductive rationality, what the Frankfurt School might call an instrumental rationality, and on the other hand, belief, and beyond that, beauty, art, the aesthetic, the non-rational, and Jung, I think, is really at the center of that debate. And curiously, this phenomenon of the UFO, I think, exemplifies that mixture between how do you explain it rationally, and how do you explain it rationally if it's something which is essentially irrational.
Mm-hmm. So let's circle back to the beginning, how I was supposed to start this episode, which is that you just got back from a conference in Sweden, and I just got back from a conference in Houston, Texas. And both of us would like to share a little bit about what we were doing that kind of to set more of this up.
Sure.
So tell us a little bit about your time in Sweden and the talk that you gave, which the theme of the conference was the underworld, right?
Yeah, that's right. The exact title was De Profundis. Okay, so indexing the Latin form of the psalm, out of the depths I cry to you, De Profundis, on the transmutations of the underworld. A lovely little conference symposium that was arranged by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson or Jonsson Foundation for public benefit, and it brought together scholars from various areas. We were looking at ancient Greece, we were looking at the Middle Ages, we were looking at John Dee, we were looking at contemporary Korean forms of understanding the underworld. And I was speaking to the topic, which I was invited to do so, on mining the underworld, Freud and Jung, and their approach to what is beneath. And I think the case I was trying to make was that Jung's Red Book, I mean, it's got a chapter called Descent into Hell in the Future. I mean, if that isn't about diving down to the depths, I don't know what is. And of course, the theme of catabasis is very important for Jung. There have been some conferences which I've taken part in where we've looked at that theme as well. So it nicely brought together for me various aspects of Jung that I've been looking at, and the members of the Jonsson Foundation were kind and generous hosts. So a big thank you to them for hosting me and everybody else for the last few days.
That's fascinating. And you were posting photos on Twitter, and your Twitter/X name is @PaulBishop4U. There'll be a link in the show notes. You're posting photos, and thank you for sharing those. I always love seeing that. So again, the name of your talk was Mining the Mind's Depth, Freud and Jung in the Underworld. And we think that will be available on their website at some point.
That's the plan. The symposium was filmed. There was also a little interview that they did. They got a couple of us to have a chat about themes that are related from the conference. And I understand that's part of the ongoing work for the foundation to have an online TV channel of some kind. So it's very much work in progress. But if folk go to the foundation's website, they should find updates there as to when all the talks are going to be available.
Nice. I will also promote that as soon as it becomes available on speakingofjung.com.
Thank you. Great. Very much.
Yeah. And the conference that I was just at was held at Rice University. It was their third time doing this, because Rice University houses something called the Archives of the Impossible. And this year, the topic of their conference was the UFO and the impossible. And it was an academic conference. It wasn't the typical UFO conference like I've attended in the past, which if you've listened to this podcast or followed me on social media, you'll know that I've attended Contact in the Desert and the Conscious Life Expo and even Alien Con. This was very different. And I brought with me here, or I have included here, the list of speakers from each of the days. And you'll see here that there was, it was hosted by Jeffrey Kripal, who is a professor of religion there at Rice University. And he knows a lot of our guests, and a lot of people are very familiar with his work because he does a lot of podcasts. And do you know Professor Kripal?
Not personally, but you're absolutely right, through podcasts and interviews with him online. Yeah, he's a big figure.
Yeah. And his most recent book, How to Think Impossibly, he cites a guest of this show, Dr. Harold Ottmansbacher, quite a bit in that book. So I'll provide a link to that in the show notes. But anyway, I don't want to spend too much time on this. Diana Pasulka was our guest in episode Q14, our quarantine series. She is a professor of religious studies at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. And I actually got a chance to sit down with her for a couple hours one-on-one just to kind of share our ideas with one another. Professor Gary Nolan from Stanford and Timothy Gallaudet, a retired Rear Admiral in the U.S. Navy. There was a retired colonel from the U.S. Army, astronomers, physicists, I'll bring up page two of this program. There was a panel discussion on the ethics of contact, and another one of our quarantine series guests, Mike Cleland, was a speaker. And there was a panel discussion on religion and the UFO with professors from the University of Chicago, Claremont Graduate University, Benedictine College, Loyola Marymount. And there was a fireside chat with one of the original remote viewers, Paul Smith, who has a PhD in parapsychology now. And another professor, it was an odd mix. Mm-hmm. They wanted to cover the nuts and bolts aspect of UFOs. They also wanted to represent experiencers and what that means, people who have actually seen UFOs, people who have reportedly experienced interaction with UFOs and beings from the UFOs. They call themselves experiencers. And then the religious aspect of this as well. There were several professors of religious studies here. There was also a mix of others as well. And it was kind of all over the place. And I sat in the front row. Well, the first two rows were reserved for speakers. So the first row that attendees could sit in was row three. I got there an hour to 2 hours early each of the 3 days, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, sat right in the center because my bad eyesight, right in the center, right in the front, took notes the entire time.
Right.
And I want to share some of it. I'm really torn because where I started on this topic and where I am now are very different.
Sure.
And I want you as an academic and as someone who has had a lifelong interest in this topic, is that correct?
I think I've always been attracted to things before, without having read a word of Derrida. I think I always sense that it's on the margins that the really interesting things take place. And it's been a topic which the more people say, well, you know, you mustn't go there, mustn't talk about it, and so on, like the occult, or perhaps more generally, what is now known as the esoteric. I mean, that's a category which has really come into its own. Would you agree? In the last few years, and it's almost sort of become mainstream, and so on. So it's something where I'd say that I've always kept an eye on the developments that are happening there, and it dovetailed, of course, with my growing interest in Jung, who, as we've been saying, writes this essay and has this little collection of communications and letters in volume 18. So the two things sort of nurtured each other mutually, I'd say.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to say, make no mistake, this essay is difficult to understand because it is a mixture of facts as far as what news reports have come out of sightings, of things that people see that they can't explain and they can't identify. And I have something to say about that. Yeah. Secondly, as a clinician, as a psychologist, as a psychiatrist, because he's both. He started off as a psychiatrist. He has a medical degree, an MD, and he developed a psychology. He cites clinical examples, specifically dreams, and the drawings, the paintings from people who have had UFO dreams, and then his theories on projection, cultural complexes, associations, the collective unconscious. So there's a lot in here. And Jung is not an easy read. And anybody who says he is not understanding what he's really saying.
Yeah, no, that's
so
right.
Where would you like to begin in covering what Jung says in this essay? I mean, where do we begin? I have, as usual, I have pages and pages and pages of notes here. And there's no way we can get to all this. And I was trying to organize it, and I simply couldn't, because I kept going off on tangents.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I share your sense of the difficulty that one encounters when reading this essay, and in some respects, we find those difficulties with other writings of Jung as well. I mean, mm-hmm. I'm thinking of the very first big book, Symbols and Transformations of the Libido, and it shares that quality of, you know, being all over the place, as it were. I mean, it's dragging in material left, right, and left, right, and center. And you've highlighted the kind of prodigious number of themes that Jung manages to fit in the pages there. So I think that's one analog that we can find elsewhere. I think of another work which is about the same time, or well, 1951, a little bit later. Answer to Job. Which again has a very complex architecture, and I think Answer to Job, which is for me in many ways perhaps the best piece of writing that Jung ever did. And yeah. The structure really does pose challenges for the reader, and I think we have to say, well, you know, is this incompetence on Jung's part, or is it rather that the whole thing is to restructure the way that we have an understanding? And I think that the only way to approach Answer to Job, from my point of view, is to make a photocopy, cut it all up, rearrange it on your living room floor, and then get a sense of, so the chronology that Jung presents is very different from the biblical chronology, and there's a tension that's been played out in those two things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I am planning on doing an episode about that, but haven't gotten there yet. So this essay and our experiences.
Yeah.
Let's go. It was published in, I think it was written in 1958, published in 1959,
yeah.
Widely published in many different formats. I've counted 12 covers so far. Mm-hmm. He mentions flying saucers, which let's talk about that term. That's yeah. what they were originally called, flying saucers, here in the United States anyway, flying saucers. Yeah. Then UFO, short for unidentified flying object. Now, recently, I'd say within the past 9 years, UAP, unidentified anomalous phenomena, specifically because they have been seen coming out of the water.
Yeah.
So that's not flying. But to me, they're still flying because they're moving.
Yeah.
How else are they moving, getting up into the air? Anyway, UAP is the new term. I'm not using it right now. What do you think of the term flying saucers and how Jung specifically focuses specifically on the round shape throughout this essay. Now, yeah. since then, there have been other shapes.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's a good starting point. I mean, the actual term flying saucer is in some way has a sort of skepticism built into it. I mean, it's a slightly ridiculous term in some way. UFO or whatever the modern acronym is I suppose a sort of reaction to that, and so on. For me, I think the most important thing is that while the essay is about, ostensibly, about flying saucers, about UFOs, it isn't in the original title. It isn't in the original title.
Okay, so tell us.
So the original title doesn't mention flying saucers. It's when it's published in English form that gets added.
Ah.
Yeah. And so in the German original, which was the basis of the translation by Hull, you just have what we know as the subtitle. So if we take that flying saucers out, I think that can help us get into the essay. That means that the real title is what we know as the subtitle, Ein moderner Mythos von Dingen, die am Himmel gesehen werden. So the modern myth of things seen in the skies. And I think we've got two things that are going on there. I mean, again, those things are held in tension by a colon in the original German title. The first thing is, of course, a modern myth.
Yes.
And so it's that great Jungian theme about myth, but this is going to be about a modern myth. So
yeah.
it's going to be zeitgemäß, it's going to be topical in some way. And I think, well, obviously Jung is one of the great thinkers and theoreticians of myth, but perhaps the most useful definition of it, which I think exemplifies how Jung uses the term, is the definition of myth that was given in the 4th century by Celestius, where he says that myth is about things that never happened but always are. Things that never happened but always are. And I think that's such a tricky and such an interesting formulation. And I think that ties in very well with the way that Jung says, and this is perhaps we want to come talk about this, his great theoretical move is to say, well, I'm not talking about UFOs. I'm talking about the UFO phenomenon. He says, things are seen, but I'm not saying what it is that's been seen. And I think that's central to the move that he's making. So again, we might want to come back to that. Second part of the title in German, von Dingen, die einmal gesehen werden, slightly occluded, slightly less obvious in the English translation of things seen in the skies, but it comes across very, very strongly in the German, the biblical allusion. The biblical allusion to things will be seen in the skies, the signs that will be seen in the skies, in the great eschatological passages that one finds in the Gospels, one finds in Luke, but also in the Acts of the Apostles, in the Revelation, the idea of the signs in the heavens. And so we have, this is maybe about flying saucers, but what Jung in his title is doing is flagging up, first of all, myth, and second, biblical illusion, eschatology, the end of time. So we're dealing with something which is about revealed religion. So myth and religion are, I think, what this book is really about.
Myth and religion is what this book is really about. Do you see a connection between what people are seeing in the skies today and saying this is unidentified and what people were seeing in the 1200s, the 1500s, the 1700s?
What Jung's case is going to be absolutely that there is the continuity, and one of the book covers that you showed us reproduced this lovely Basel woodcut from the 13th century, which one finds included in it. There it is, and I think it's a typical Jungian move to say what folk were seeing in the sky. In the 12th, 13th, 14th century, this directly connects with what people say they're seeing in the sky now. And I think I'd emphasize that point. That's what it seems to me that Jung is always very careful to emphasize, that it's about what people say they're seeing. And Jung is not going to weigh in on determining what it is that they have or haven't seen. It's enough. That's why he calls it the UFO phenomenon, that the people are talking about it. And so Jung is, as a psychiatrist, as a psychologist, as an analytical psychologist, is going to be asking the question, why would people say that? Why would they do that? And his amplificatory technique, which is to look at all the associations that you find with a particular mythologem, that one of the ways that he prosecutes that case is to say, well, let's look back to the historical analogues, like these wonderful woodcuts which he includes, including that, I think, one of the most beautiful ones, it's translated as the spiritual pilgrim discovering another world, that great picture of someone peering outside the kind of umbrella of phenomenalism and acceding in a visual way to what lies beyond the stars. Mm-hmm. And I think that and what they see out there are, it's a wonderful picture. They've got sort of wheels spinning and things which are in motion there. Jung is trying to connect what people are saying in the 1940s, 1950s, 60s, and so on, is connecting back to what their forebears will have seen, where there is where the religious connection is much more obvious. Today, I think Jung would always say that connection has become attenuated, but Jung is wanting to track it all the more keenly. That's at least what I would see him doing.
Mm-hmm. So I did some research on when was the first UFO sighting in the United States, and they seem to be mostly in the United States, but certainly they're not just here. Yeah. And what I noticed is that they seem to correlate to the United States military and our aircraft.
Yeah.
So we're going to get to that. But what I found out and didn't know is that the first recorded sighting, which when you just asked that general question, when was the first recorded UFO sighting in the United States? I get two conflicting dates on the Kenneth Arnold, who was a pilot, who saw several UFOs near Mount Rainier in Washington State. Mount Rainier is this big, beautiful 14,000 foot mountain that's with a glacier on it. It's covered in snow year round. And in 1945 or 1947, no, that was not the first recorded sighting. The first recorded sighting I found was in 1639, when near Boston, some people were on a river, or they were in marshland, and it was at night, and they saw something. Well, in 1639, they didn't at that time know about this phenomenon about the combustion of gas from decomposed organic matter, and that happens over marshland at night. So there are all kinds, what I'm trying to say here is that there are all kinds of things that happen naturally in nature. And it's what's interesting, and what I think Jung was focusing on with this essay is not what's happening in the external world, but what's happening in the internal world, and what happens in the psyche when we see something that we don't understand. This is the whole point here. When we see something we don't understand, we can't identify, what do we project on it?
Yeah.
That's what this is all about.
Yeah.
So I used this example. I was in Seattle a few years ago, maybe 10 or 15 years ago, and I was photographing the bay, Elliott Bay. And because there was this beautiful, odd-looking kind of round rainbow with a light in the sky. This was during the day. And I photographed it because I had never seen anything like it. And I'm always looking at the sky. And I posted it on Twitter, and somebody, sure enough, told me it was a sundog. I had no idea about sundogs, and they sent me a link to read about sundogs. So what I'm trying to say is I saw something. I didn't know what it was. Isn't it interesting the conclusions that we jump to? So I didn't jump to that it was a UFO or that it was something supernatural. It was something I'd never seen before, very unusual. I photographed it. Where are all the photographs of all the these other things people see? And then it was identified. Just because we can't identify something or don't know what it is doesn't mean it's from an alien species. So what I think Jung was looking at is the psyche of the individual having the sighting or having the experience. What are their associations? What's going on in the psyche? What do you say to that?
I think that's a very persuasive way of looking at it, Laura. I think I think you've focused in on several really important things. One is that one response is well, one response is obviously sort of, you know, why do I believe in anything. Another response is the pleasure that one can take in trying to debunk these accounts and so on, or provide a natural explanation for it. But I think Jung, who makes this point, I'm talking about things which are seen. So there is something which is seen. And he's not going to get caught up in this argument about, well, I'm going to kind of, you know, give a rationalist debunking of this or give a natural historical kind of explanation for something that's happening, or a refraction of light or the sun dog or whatever. He says, what's interesting, and I think you've brought that out very well, is how that information is interpreted by human beings who are meaning-seeking animals.
Yes.
Meaning-seeking individuals. Mm-hmm. And who are going to construct a meaning, or that makes it sound a little too active, will find awakened in themselves a structure or a way of making sense of it, which is, I think, what Jung means by the archetypal. I mean, you know, this big Jungian terms to, you know, the archetypes, but the archetypes aren't just sort of these, you know, funky little animations which are going around dancing in the collective unconscious and so on. It's about how we structure, as I would understand it, our experiences in ways that are going to be trans-individual, trans-historical, and that's, after all, how, as I would understand it, that's what Jung's really getting at with the collective unconscious. It's going to be a propensity for human beings, as human beings, as meaning-seeking animals, meaning-seeking individuals, that there are going to be patterns of construction of meaning that go on, or preformed senses of meaning into which these experiences are going to fit. And that, I think, is such a beautiful account, because it's not a reductionist account. It's not simply about debunking something. It's about saying, well, why should that have been significant? And I think this then ties into the way that Jung associates certain geometric patterns, circles being one obvious case, quaternities being another case, as being expressive of this key Jungian notion of totality. So what one finds in that Basel woodcut, what one finds in these other accounts and illustrations, including the ones that Jung looks at from the dreams of patients, but also modernist artwork as well, it's going to be how do these dreams, how do these works of art perform this totality-creating function which Jung identifies with the creation, the discovery of the self?
Mm-hmm. So I want to mention that you and I are obviously coming from two different backgrounds. You're a professor, you're a Jung scholar. For me, I live in the United States where UFOs are a thing. And I also neglected to mention, I know I've mentioned this on other episodes, that starting in the 1980s, the late 1980s, when I was living in Cleveland, Ohio, I would attend monthly meetings of the Cleveland Ufology Project. It is happens to be the oldest continually meeting UFO group in the United States, if not the world. I think it's been meeting since the 1950s. And for the record, I have never seen a UFO. I have seen things in the sky that I couldn't explain, but nothing that makes me think this was a UFO. I've not had alien abduction experience. That's another thing. So there are two things that I didn't mention. There seem to be two topics going on here: seeing UFOs and people who are having experiences with what they think are the operators of these craft, these machines, these alien beings, and people who claim to have had not only interaction with them, but were either given information by them or were taken by them and then returned. Mm-hmm. So this is a very big subject, and today we're just really looking at focusing on UFOs because that's the topic of Jung's essay. But as you explained, it kind of is and it kind of isn't. Yeah. I would like to, we're probably going to go long here today. I would like to go through these notes in Memories, Dreams, Reflections, which is Jung's, it's called his autobiography. It's, let's just call it that for now. Yeah. The protocols are coming out later this year.
Sometime in December. Soon.
December is the publication date. So let's see, right?
A perfect Christmas stocking gift.
Wonderful. There you go. Right. Worldwide rumors of UFOs, this is Jung in Memories, Dreams, Reflections, of which we began to hear as early as 1945. Me, this is what I'm saying, 1945 is the year that we, the U.S., dropped from airplanes two atomic bombs on Japan. UFOs were... people started seeing UFOs in 1945, the same year that we, with aircraft, dropped bombs on Japan. I mean, what I'm trying to say is that it seems to me that these unidentified flying objects could be experimental aircraft. So why I say that, what's implied there is all the testing that had to occur before we had the capability to drop an atomic bomb.
Yeah.
First, we had to have the aircraft to do that. Then we had to have the bomb technology, then the ability to drop a bomb on a target. So I wonder about all the testing that had to go on to get to that point. So when we have people, I just want to say one more thing. When we have people who are witnesses to things, and these witnesses have credibility because they are Navy pilots, and they're saying, United States military, we don't have anything that can go that fast. We don't have anything that can go that high. We don't have anything that can make those maneuvers. How do you know? You're not privy to all the private, confidential, classified information on experimental aircraft. You don't know.
I think that's well said, Laura. Just to pick up on the first point you were making there, I should say that I've never seen a UFO either. I should go out to Bonnie Bridge more often, which is just up the road from where I am, where apparently there's a great number of sites, UFO sightings, which are seen there. But I've never seen one. I've not been abducted, or if I have, then the memory drug is really working very well. I have no recollection of it at all, and I'm quite pleased about that. I'm not sure I want a tractor beam coming into the room and taking me out. So I don't have any experiences like that I can draw on. But crucially, nor does Jung. I mean, and Jung makes the point very clearly in his essay and in the collection of statements, which is there in volume 18. He says, I've never seen one either. So it's, but that in a way qualifies him to talk about it. And I'm going to sort of ride on the back of that and say it qualifies me to talk about it as well, because in that sense, I don't have any particular skin in the game. I'm not, likewise with yourself, we're not trying to persuade people of, whether or not we've seen something and whatever the construction is that we're going to put on it. But I think Jung's important point is there are people who say that they have seen these things, and there are people who say that they have had these encounters and so on. And that is a phenomenological fact. I mean, you know, that's what he's seeking to explain. And one obvious reason, one obvious explanation which kind of shuts down the debate is to say, well, you know, these people are simply bonkers or whatever, and, you know, to dismiss it out of hand that way, as people would also do with ghosts, as people also do with the occult, as people would also do with other fringe areas and so on. But Jung, shrewdly, is so much more nuanced. He's not going to commit himself to a particular epistemological account. You know, he's not going to explain, well, this is going to do with military aircraft, or this is going to do with weather balloons or whatever. But there are people who choose not to accept those explanations. And I think they're very good explanations. And I think you're absolutely right to draw attention to this a coincidence, which is more than a coincidence, between the military actions taken in 1945, and then this is where the number of sightings really takes off. But I think one could look at it in another way, which is to say that the explosion of those bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki triggers off something in the psyche as well.
Yes.
That kind of expression of power, that kind of destructivity, that is something which is not without a psychic effect. And I think that although Jung is very, very sparing in his comments, both written and spoken, about talking about the atomic bomb, talking about the Holocaust, talking about Auschwitz, whilst he never explicitly goes into those areas, there are numerous dark hints and remarks where he talks about how godlike the human being has become to human beings' detriment. And I think that the idea of those bombs not only destroying the poor people onto whom they are dropped, but also triggering something more broadly in what one would call the collective psyche, not in a mystical, but in a phenomenological sense, that's what makes Jung's essay so important.
I wanted to look at this clinically, but neither of us are clinicians. And what I neglected to mention when I was showing the program from the Archives of the Impossible conference at Rice University, not one psychologist was there.
Interesting. Okay?
Nobody talked about what this means psychologically.
Yeah.
And no one ever does. Mm. Seldom. There was one professor there, which I will get to, who seemed to get it. Mm-hmm. And all of these years of doing this podcast, I could not find a single Jungian analyst who was interested or willing to discuss this with me on this podcast. And then while I was preparing, because you and I decided to do this several months ago, while I was preparing for this episode, I found out that while I was on hiatus, the C.G. Jung Institute of Los Angeles held a panel discussion back in January of this year, with four Jungian analysts talking specifically about the title of the presentation was the same as ours, Flying Saucers, A Modern Myth of Things Seen in the Skies. I was given access to the recording and watched it several times. There was an analyst who talked about his UFO sightings. I was stunned. He alluded to, and then we actually had a phone conversation about it, his interaction with beings. And he said this publicly, so I'll say it. He claims to have been chased by men in black for 20 years. Okay. There was an analyst talking about a UFO sighting she had in the 70s. And then she went over Jung's terminology that he used in this essay. Then there was another analyst who said that this topic is like playing hide and seek, like playing with the chemical mercury. It will not allow you to grasp it. Mm-hmm. And finally, the executive director, the current executive director of the Jung Institute in Los Angeles, is a quantum physicist, and he is an analyst in training. His name is Christoph Lamuel. He is studying AI and says that the two are related. We are dealing with another intelligence. I found that very interesting because if this is just experimental aircraft, think about this. Not only do we have commercial aircraft and private aircraft, we have military aircraft. We also have space travel, rockets to the moon, developing a rocket to go to Mars. And then also, I have a friend who was the PI for the mission to Pluto. Mm-hmm. So man created a device that can go to Pluto. Mm-hmm. And it went beyond Pluto. Mm-hmm. all of this involves a lot of experimentation. So how is it that we're dealing with another intelligence? Where is, I don't want to say where's the proof, but where is the proof? I'm mad. So speaking of that, you wanted me to mention some of the things that I heard at the Archives of the Impossible. And yeah. I have to scroll through my notes. Professor Gary Nolan from Stanford University said that we should be talking about this in a mature and professional manner, using the rigor of academic limitations. But then he went on to ridicule people who said, where's the evidence? And his response is, I'm not your daddy. You know, so I have not seen any evidence. Where are the photos? Where are the videos? Why? Another argument I hear is, well, they're not photogenic. Well, how convenient.
Yeah.
So do you see this as Dr. Lemuel said, that we're dealing with another intelligence?
Well, just to pick up, first of all, on the final point you're making there, it would seem surprising, given the ubiquity of iPhones and handheld cameras, that there isn't more compelling visual evidence that's going to be. I mean, everybody's got a camera with them, you know, almost 24 hours a day. So if there were things that were whizzing around above our heads, then you'd think you'd have much more compelling evidence for it. But I'm going back to what Jung says. He's not saying there's something in the sky. He's saying there is something which is seen. And I'm going to bracket out that whatever that something is, because that's not what I'm interested in, I think, is Jung's case. I'm interested in the fact that people say that they've seen these things. I suppose he would say, in response to some of the examples you were giving from that seminar, he'd say, I'm interested into the reasons why somebody would self-disclose in such a way. Maybe we can come back to various analogies for these inhabitants of the craft or beings that are said to be encountered, but Jung, I think, is very clear and specific about this point. I'm going to lay on one side the question as to what that thing is, and I'm going to discuss the significance which accrues to it. And I think, in many ways, we find Jung is, yeah, he's a clinician in some respects, but he's also academic in the way that he, you know, provides footnotes, gives us historical evidence rather than photographic evidence and so on. And I think his essay in many ways shows the great complementarity that can be there, which can be there, isn't always, but sometimes is there, between the clinical on the one hand and the academic on the other. And I think that where the clinical can benefit from the academic is with a greater sense of intellectual rigor, and to pursue a essentially rational argument in support of the case that's being made. But equally, I think that the academics have a lot to learn from the clinicians as well. That is to say, to understand that the argument does not just involve understanding, but involves feeling, it's empathy. There is, how shall I say, an emotional intelligence that's required to talk about these things. Ultimately, I think Jung is more interested in emotional intelligence than artificial intelligence.
Interesting. A little bit ago, I mentioned a professor at the conference, the Archives of the Impossible, who I thought was really the only one there who got it. His name is Dr. James Madden from Benedictine College. And he also said, we are ruled by an elite class of billionaires. He said the big other, he was referring to it as the big other, he said, does not govern us consciously. I thought that was very interesting. Because he was the only one who said, we are not conscious of what we do. So to me, he was considering the power of the unconscious. Mm-hmm. I did not hear that anywhere all weekend from anyone. Prior to Dr. Madden's talk, there was another professor from another university who shared her encounter experience. Wasn't just seeing a UFO, it was actually encountering and interacting with it. To me, it sounded exactly like a dream. And she gave her associations. She even used the term like, literally like. I was just beside myself. I couldn't believe it, because these people, yes, I do believe that they are seeing something and experiencing something. But again, their interpretation of what they're seeing and experiencing is where I take issue, because these people are not looking at themselves. They're not looking at what's going on with them. They've not been analyzed. I don't know anybody that's been analyzed that thinks that they saw a UFO and was from another planet or were abducted. So are these people experiencing trauma, post-traumatic stress disorder, not from the experience, but before the experience?
Well, I think you make an interesting point there, which is what do these people see themselves as doing? And I'm wondering if I can sort of set up a comparison with the case of visionaries like Dame Julian of Norwich, for example, who has these showings, who has these visions, or Marjorie Kemp. We could think of numerous examples there of saints, of visionaries who would say, well, I have seen angels or I have seen devils. It's interesting that those sorts of theological categories also seem to map onto the beings that are said to be encountered. Benign on the one hand, hostile on the other, just as we have angels and demons in the Christian worldview. And for Dame Julian of Norwich, her showings are, I actually have seen these things. And perhaps that's the only account that she's able to give. She has the theological apparatus, which is proper to her as someone who is a believer, is proper to the culture, the religious culture of her time as well. And so naturally, whatever happens to her is then interpreted in that particular interpretative mold. Today, with the relative occlusion of religion, this is why we have the modern myth of the UFO, of the alien being, and one can seek analogies for those in the entire tradition that's there across the globe, but very strongly in Europe, of the so-called little people, of the gnomes, the dwarves, the elves, the pixies, these creatures that manifest themselves only very occasionally, only to a few people. Only a few people who get to see them, and who may be benign in intent, or in the case of the sort of Rip Van Winkle and so on, that they actually steal people away from themselves and so on. And we might therefore think of these alien beings as being a modern instantiation of these, the little folk, the fairy folk that we know from myth and legend.
Another thing I heard from one of the panelists was, he said, we have not expanded our consciousness. And I thought, what have you done to expand your consciousness? I entered into analysis not because I was mentally ill, but because I wanted to become more conscious. So I just heard a bunch of people sitting around saying, we haven't done this, we haven't done that. And I thought, what are you doing as an individual? Instead of blaming the group or society or your country or your race or your religion, it's your responsibility to tend to your own psyche. And I wonder how well do these people know themselves, their complexes, their projections, their shadow, their anima or animus? I just kept hearing a bunch of words thrown out, a bunch of big words, word salad. When they would say we, I'm thinking, you really mean you, but are you owning any of this?
Yeah.
Are you owning any of this? So remember I said that there were three groups represented, the nuts and bolts, as far as the speed of these UFOs, what they look like, how they appear, how, how they moved, the G-forces, all of those things, the nuts and bolts of structured crafts that we're seeing, but we have no photos of. Then the experiencers. To me, my concern is, and it's a big concern that I have with these experiencers, is they tend to develop groups and they get into this group think and they all reinforce each other instead of saying, I need to find out what's going on inside of me.
Yeah.
I need to enter into psychoanalysis to find out what's going on in me.
Yeah.
You know, they struggle, they suffer, they're outcasts, they're ridiculed, they are experiencing post-traumatic stress disorder. But what are they doing to tend to their own psyche?
Yeah.
You can't do that just with somebody else just like you.
Yeah.
It's not going to work. And I don't, I don't see these people getting treatment.
Yeah. No. I hear where you're coming from on that, and I think that you've identified something there, which is very often, not always, but it can sometimes be the case with conferences of any kind, or that a sort of groupthink, as you rightly describe it, which emerges, and it's people of one conviction reinforcing their convictions in the group, rather than allowing it to be challenged or exploring it, and I think I can understand why you think that there would be something which is clinically problematic about it. I think from my point of view, I think I'd see there's something rhetorically or something argumentationally wrong about it, because simply getting together with a group of people and rehearsing the same ideas over and over again isn't going to advance things very, very far. And I think that's true. That's not just true of conferences about UFOs or cult matters or anything which is esoteric, but it's also a problem, I think, for the mainstream, that you tend to get people, say, literary scholars or historical scholars who take a particular view and then want to have the conference as a kind of opportunity for mutually reinforcing that. It's very difficult. And I think it's a difficulty to which Jung alludes in various ways in Memories, Dreams, Reflections. It's extremely difficult to extract oneself from that sort of discursive, monolithic block. I think that's what he's really talking about. I don't know if you agree when he's talking about his experiences in school, when he's talking about his experiences as a young man in Basel, that is a very strong, almost totalitarian bourgeois culture, which keeps him limited in various ways. I'm thinking about the discussion he talks about with his relatives. They talk about the same old things day in, day out. They don't want to talk about Jakob Burckhardt. They don't want to talk about Friedrich Nietzsche. You know, in retrospect, we see those as part of the great Basel culture at the end of the 19th century. But Jung's saying no. In fact, these things were quite marginalized. It was the safety of the same old repetition of ideas. That's what he wanted to break free from. Interestingly, both first of all as someone pursuing science, and then through the route of psychology, and I think one could see his entire 20 works as continually launching an appeal to self-reflection on the part of the reader. Why do you think the things that you do? Look at all the various analogies he's going to say, and he can point to historical examples in Western culture and in non-Western culture across millennia, and say, look, if you understand that there's an analog for what you're experiencing, you'll be able to process that for yourself so much better. That's why there is this therapeutic dimension to the interest in myth and legend, which is equally, I think, part of the historical cultural project of analytical psychology as well.
Interesting. Thank you for sharing that. I'm going to jump in with back to the Los Angeles Jung Institute panel discussion. The analyst, Mary Beth Carter, made the point of wondering, of asking, what are we hoping for with all of this? What are we needing? What is it that you need for greater psychic balance? I mean, spoken like a true Jungian analyst, right? Yeah. What's out of balance here? And that's, I think, what I'm seeing these experiencers not considering. They're not considering any of this. Yeah. How is this a compensation for what else is going on in your life? Mm-hmm. Because it's so interesting then when you mention pixies and fairies and only certain people can see them, why is it that I can't? Mm-hmm. I've never seen a pixie or a fairy. I remember being outside of Cle Elum, Washington, and going in this field where they were supposedly seeing leprechauns and water sprites in the stream and not seeing anything, thinking, why can't I see these things? Well, maybe the people that can see them, they've not worked with the unconscious. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I just want to say that. I just want to put that out there. Maybe they've never worked with their unconscious.
So you think this projection into, because I think that comes very close to one of the things that Jung proposes as an explanation is when he's talking about the fact that UFOs seem to be able to be tracked through the use of radar, that he suggests that in some sense it's possible to create a projection which has some sort of solidity or can be tracked by radar or whatever. And I think that's an interesting idea because it's this way of overcoming this Cartesian dualism between the rational and the physical, the sensual world. And I think your point there about if there's something which can be projected out into the world, it's not that all the dancers or all the pixies and fairies are dancing around waiting to be seen, but they're waiting to be projected from within the individual outward. And I think that's a dynamic which underpins Jung's thesis as he presents it in this essay on flying saucers as well.
Mm. Well, now I want to be clear here that I was mixing the two, the UFO and the seeing beings, whether they be fairies or aliens. I do believe people are seeing something in the sky that I'm not saying that they're projecting. Yeah. Now, again, it could be a sun dog, marsh gas. I know that sounds ridiculous, but we see things all the time that we've never seen before that we don't have any explanation for because we're not educated on that topic. But there's usually an explanation in nature for it. Mm-hmm. There are unusual things that occur that are rare, but still it's nature, it's natural. My concern is what people are projecting on it. If you see experimental aircraft, secret technology, drone technology, very advanced drone technology, maybe that isn't ours, maybe that's from another country. And you're saying that's a UFO from another planet piloted by aliens who visit me at night. That's where I question that narrative.
Yeah.
And what is it in you that came up with that? Let's put Jung's terms aside. What is it in you that came up with that whole story about what you saw? What does it say about your psychology, your unconscious? And something else that I keep forgetting to mention, and it's somewhere in the notes, I'm not going to look for it. I'm just going to talk. One of the other things I hear a lot is that when you mentioned dichotomy, I hear people saying it's either this or I'm crazy or I'm bonkers or I'm a nut job. You know what? There are lots of different forms of mental illness. Mental illness isn't maybe what you think it is.
No, for sure.
So for the people that I see and encounter and experienced in the groups, and not just at the conference, but for the decades since I got into this in the late 1980s, there are a lot of wounded people walking around. There are a lot of people with unresolved trauma walking around. Unresolved issues walking around, chemical imbalances walking around, untreated. So don't tell me that mental illness does not factor into this. And for you to say, well, I know this person isn't crazy. What is crazy? Mm-hmm. What does crazy mean? If you have unresolved trauma, that doesn't necessarily mean you're crazy.
Yeah.
It means that you are wounded and you're going to experience symptoms, maybe more than a neurosis, more than that. And left untreated, it's going to regress. And it's going to come out some way, somehow.
I think that's well said, Laura. And it just occurs to me that there's a passage, I think, where Jung speaks very directly to the kinds of issues that you've been talking about. He says, this is in the first chapter, page 15 in the Routledge edition, at any rate, he says, hence there appear signs in the heavens. Okay, and that's this biblical echo that I was trying to emphasize earlier. Hence there appear signs in the heavens, superior beings in the kind of spaceships devised by our technological fantasy. From a fear whose cause is far from being fully understood and is therefore not conscious, there arise explanatory projections which purport to find the cause in all manner of secondary phenomena, however unsuitable. Some of these projections are so obvious it seems almost superfluous to dig any deeper. And he goes on to say, the universal mass rumor was reserved for our enlightened rationalistic age. So there we have that critique about the hyper-rationalism that makes Jung and the Frankfurt School so extraordinarily close together. The widespread fantasy about the destruction of the world at the end of the first millennium was metaphysical in origin and needed no UFOs in order to appear rational. Heaven's intervention was quite consistent with the Weltanschauung of the age. But nowadays, public opinion would hardly be inclined to resort to the hypothesis of a metaphysical act. Otherwise, innumerable persons would already have been preaching about the warning signs in heaven. Our Weltanschauung does not expect anything of this sort. We would be much more inclined to think of the possibility of psychic disturbances and interventions, especially as our psychic equilibrium has become something of a problem since the last World War. Even our historians can no longer make any use of the conventional techniques in evaluating and explaining the developments that have overtaken Europe in the last few decades, but must admit that psychological and psychopathological factors are beginning to widen the horizons of historiography in an alarming way. I think that beautifully responds to and reacts to and engages with what you were saying there, Laura.
Thank you for sharing that. That is a great way to wrap this up. I think we've covered quite enough, and I'd like to give you the last word if you'd like to add anything before I mention where we go from here and what our upcoming projects are.
No, thank you very much, Laura. And just to say that for me, it's been a real treat to talk with you about this text. It is a work which I think is, for various reasons that we were talking about at the beginning, tends to be looked at askance and put on one side. But it contains some of Jung's, in my view, most interesting remarks about modern and modernist art. He brings in alchemy. He brings in sort of contemporary psychological diagnosis of the kind that we were looking at. There's the whole historical aspect that he takes from these various woodcuts and pictures up until contemporary accounts. So I think one should, even if one is slightly apprehensive about it, it would be great to say this is a book where you should feel the fear and read it anyway.
I love that. I also, just as we come to a close here, I forgot about, you were speaking about Routledge and the different editions, and I was showing the various book covers. I do want to add the current Routledge cover is this one. And in the beginning, when you were saying the term flying saucers was kind of ridiculous, I thought this cover was really odd. I mean, it looks like a rusty hubcap. Yes. What is that?
Yes, I don't know. I think that's a very postmodern take on it. That's perhaps the kind of thing one could say. Yeah.
There you go. So I would like to end with saying a little bit about a presentation that you're going to be giving at the end of the month for the Scientific and Medical Network. I will be attending as well. This is April 30th. This will be on April 30th from 7 o'clock to 8:30 p.m. UK time. Your talk is titled Goethe and Jung on the Stages of Life. What does that entail?
What does that entail? Well, that's a very good question. I don't want to give it all away, but
sure.
I'm really trying to explore this idea that we find both in classical times, ancient times, about the idea of the stages of life. It's an idea that we also find classically, of course, with Jung as well, you know, the paper, The Stages of Life and von Meid. But also we find it in the writings and in the thought of Goethe as well. And he has two, to my mind, utterly astonishing phrases. One, he says, is that the human being must be ruined. And he says that the natural genius experiences a renewed puberty. I'm going to try and make sense of that and put out some ideas, and really looking forward to the discussion that takes place afterwards as well. So thank you for mentioning this this event that the Scientific and Medical Net webinars are going to be putting on for us very soon in April.
Yes, and it's on a Wednesday, and it will be online, as I said, and I will be there, and I really look forward to hearing about the stages of life. Very important.
Look forward to seeing you there, Laura. Thank you.
Yes. Well, thank you again for joining us. And we look forward to the next three volumes in your series. We spoke about the first volume in episode 135. You have three more coming up. And just briefly recap them for us. What do we have to look forward to?
Yeah, well, the Parzival one came out last year, and you and I talked about that. The next volume, which is on Goethe's Faust, is in the pipeline with Chiron at the moment.
Is it? Okay.
It is. They're working away on that. They're a great publisher to work with, really enjoying. Yes. Really enjoying working with Chiron. They've been absolutely fantastic.
Yes.
And after Goethe's Faust, it's then Nietzsche's Zarathustra. So that's something I'm going to be looking at over the summer. And if I can make it to the end, then volume four is going to be on the epic of transformation for our time. It's going to be on Jung's Red Book.
Really looking forward to that. And I hope that we get to do episodes on each of those volumes. Really looking forward to it. Thank you again for joining us.
No, you're very welcome. Thank you, Laura.
Speaking of Jung is not just a podcast. It is also a website. Please visit speakingofjung.com, where you will find extensive information on the life and work of C.G. Jung, show notes and audio downloads for all of our 163 episodes, a comprehensive books page, a blog, and now a monthly email newsletter, which you can sign up for at the bottom of our front page. All of our episodes are also available on YouTube podcasts, which you can access by subscribing to this channel, Jungian Laura. It's free. Just click the subscribe button below. I created Speaking of Jung almost 10 years ago. This year is our 10th anniversary, and all of our content is still free to access, but it is not free to produce. Please consider contributing to our tip jar on Patreon for just $5 a month, or visit our support page at speakingofjung.com/support for links on all the ways you can help keep this podcast and our website alive. So with special thanks to Patricia Preissner, Dr. Christoph Lemuel, and the C.G. Jung Institute of Los Angeles, I am Laura London, and you've been watching The Modern Myth of Speaking of Jung.